This is Catherine Chilcote interviewing my daughter, Donna, on July 29th, 2013, at my home at Lion's Head in Salisbury. Donna, give me your full name, date of birth, where you were born, those kind of things to start this with.
My full name is Donna Lee Chilcote Alexander. I was born in 1955. I have a brother, Richard, and a sister, Susan. My parents are Catherine Chilcote, and my father, who is deceased, was William Chilcote.
You were born in Sharon?
I was born at Sharon Hospital, yes. At the time, my parents lived in Lakeville on Deep Lake Farm.
Where did you go to school?
I began my schooling at a nursery school that was located in Lakeville, the name of which I cannot recall, but I went to nursery school in the house that I eventually lived in, which is the big white Victorian at the top of what used to be called Montgomery Street, but I believe is now called Sharon Road, right at the Catholic Church, where Sharon Road and Wells Hill Road separate. After nursery school, I went to the Town Hill School, which was located on the campus of Hotchkiss School and was basically a three-room elementary school that went from kindergarten to third grade. The kindergarten had one room, and then first, second, and third grades were all separated into the two classrooms. I stayed there until the end of second grade, and then I went to Salisbury Central from third grade through eighth grade. Then I went to Housatonic Valley Regional High School, and from there I went to Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
When you were at Salisbury Central, let's go back to that. Who were your closest friends in Lakeville? Who did you play with?
My closest friend was Paula McGivern. She lived down, I could cut through the Catholic Church parking lot and go down a little tiny dirt road, and then I would basically be on what they called Muck Alley, which is where the McGiverns, the Whalens, the Stantons, the Seitzes, a whole lot of the families that I hung out with lived on what was termed Muck Alley. I hung out with Barbara Peck, Nancy Pollock, who was the local Methodist minister's daughter and my best church friend. Sandy Gomez, whose family had the big farm at the top of Wells Hill Road. Sandy Sisson, whose mother worked at the Hotchkiss School. Sandy lived just a few houses up Wells Hill Road from me. And those were probably my best friends.
When you were at the high school, I know of one significant occurrence during your high school years, which was the music trip to Vienna. Could you tell us a little bit about that trip?
Sure. First, a little background. I got into the music department. Actually, a close friend of mine, Mark Alexander, talked me into trying out for the music department at the high school. And he is the younger brother of the man I just married a year ago, Rick Alexander, who I had known all my life. Mark talked me into going and talking to Gary Palmieri, who was the director of the music department at that time at the high school. And I auditioned and was accepted into the department. Gary Palmieri was a musical genius. He worked with the chorus at the high school until he got us to a level where my senior year we were invited to sing at the Festival of Three Cities in Europe. The three cities were Vienna, Budapest, and Prague. We worked really, really hard my senior year of high school to raise enough money to go to Vienna. We had to pay our own way, so to speak. And in those days, it was a huge cost, not only to our parents, but to the town in general that raised money and contributed toward us going. One of my favorite parts of raising the money was we decided that that same group of girlfriends I was just talking about, we decided that we would bake pies and sell them for Thanksgiving. It was something we knew how to do, and we had learned how to do it in home ec class at the high school. And we figured, we'll maybe sell 75, 100 pies and raise some money. Now, keep in mind that these were the days when you couldn't buy a frozen pie crust. We had to hand roll out all these pie crusts, and we offered people apple, pumpkin, mincemeat. I think those were the three that we made. And unfortunately, or fortunately, at least as a fundraiser, we ended up with orders for more than 700 pies. And we had about a week and a half to create these 700 pies. We had every oven in Lakeville baking pies. We were up till all hours of the night rolling out pie dough down at Paula's house on Muck Alley in her little tiny kitchen. It was a very good experience in seeing a project through to completion. No matter what direction it goes in, we still had to go with it. So that was a great experience. And we all flew off to Vienna, which was dazzling, of course. We sang at the palace, and the first night we were there, we ate in, it was a private dining room. It must have been a government, something at the palace, but we all remember very well that our waiters were all dressed in tuxedos, which was something that most of us small town kids had never seen before. And if we dropped an ice cube or something, the waiter would pick it up and put it in his pocket. We all wondered what they did to empty out their pockets at the end of the night. And it was the first time all of us had been served soup as a first course. And we were all relatively horrified to find that the bowls of soup each contained a chicken's foot. But we adapted. We were so exhausted and hungry at that point that we would have eaten anything. Performing in Vienna was beautiful. As we moved on to Hungary and Czechoslovakia, it became very different. At that time, those countries were still behind the Iron Curtain. Once we got over there, all the promises of the Festival of Three Cities changed, and we were told we could only hold public rehearsals. We were not allowed to perform publicly, so the people who came to hear us sing were very brave. We learned what it was to be in a country where nobody looked up from the sidewalk. Everyone kept their eyes down. There were people on the street corners with machine guns in uniforms. But somehow the people found a way to entertain us. In Hungary, they took us all out in the country to a Hungarian rodeo, and We learned a lot about the people and the culture, and we were all very relieved to come back to the United States.
Now, you wrote a series of newspaper articles about that trip, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
What paper did you write them for?
I wrote them for the Hartford Courant. I had spent the summer of my sophomore to junior year of high school, high school, I believe, writing a little bit for the Lakeville Journal. And so when the time came that the Hartford Courant wanted somebody to be their eyes and ears on the trip, somehow I got chosen to do it. And they published three very lengthy articles that I wrote about the trip, which I'm sure are still available in some archive somewhere.
Tell me a little bit now about things you did, probably not so much at the high school age, but at the early teen age. Everything from going to fairs to sock hops at the Grove to whatever you remember doing as a 12, 13-year-old.
Growing up in the Lakeville-Salisbury area in the 60s and early 70s was very different from growing up there in 2013. It was a very, very safe, idyllic place to grow up. I could get on my bike on a summer's morning at the age of 10, 11, 12 and take off for the day. And my mother's parting words would be back before the streetlights come on. We rode our bikes between each other's houses down to the Grove. We basically spent our summers just roaming and felt perfectly safe doing that because there were eyes and ears all over town keeping track of us. If we were to get into any kind of mischief, my mother was going to hear about it before the mischief was complete. So we were able to come and go as we pleased. Summers were spent basically laying on towels at the town Grove, listening to our transistor radios, which nobody has a transistor radio anymore. And drinking ice-cold bottles of Coca-Cola that came out of the cooler at the little store at the Grove. And if we needed money to buy another Coke, we walked around the beach and talked other people into giving us their empty bottles because you could return the empty bottle at the Grove store and get either 2 cents back, which you could use toward your next bottle of Coke, or you could get a pretzel stick. So I remember those days, jumping off the rafts, swimming under the little raft, doing things that today parents would be appalled at the danger of what we were doing. Out between the little raft and the big raft was something called the log. And it was a log that was probably 5 feet long and maybe a foot and a half in diameter. And it just floated there. And it was chained to the bottom. And you could seesaw on the log and ride the log and roll the log. And it was basically, we would go out and tread water and watch the boys do stupid things on the log. Obviously, the log was removed many years ago because it was dangerous. So today's kids don't know anything about that. We would go to sock hops on Friday nights down at the Grove. Our parents would drop us off at the Grove building up on the hill, and somebody would spin 45s. And for those of you who don't know what 45s are, they were little tiny records. All the big hits came out on 45s, and we would buy our 45s with our allowance down at the Ben Franklin store, which no longer exists. It was right in front of the entrance to the ball field in Lakeville. And they stocked a full selection of 45s, and they cost us in those days, I believe, 49 cents a piece. And they had an A side and a B side. So we danced to 45s at the sock hops, which we dressed up for. You know, we would put on stockings, and I remember the biggest thrill of my life of the sock hops was walking home one evening, and Michael Hickey, who was the bad boy of town and also, of course, the cutest boy in town, threw me into Factory Pond. And that made me so special in the eyes of my girlfriends that I rode on that for months afterwards. So it really was an idyllic time in my life and in the life of the town.
Now, you lived with your parents and your brother and sister in what was called the Roberts House up by the Catholic Church. And that house had a significant amount of property with it, in what we thought of as being significant in downtown Lakeville. And tell us a little about your father's farming background that prompted him to turn that property into a mini farm and teach you what it was like to be a farm girl.
Well, I was really blessed with the parents that I got, because they were so totally different and from such different backgrounds. My mother came from New York society and knew all there was to know about shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord & Taylor and art museums and classical music and all of those wonderful things that come out of an urban culture. My father was born and raised dirt poor down in Sparks, Maryland, right on the Mason-Dixon line. The son of a farmer. He was born in 1913. He was significantly older than my mother. So as I grew up, I got the best of both worlds. From my mother, I learned about good quality clothing and history and those sorts of things. And from my father, I learned a love of the land and the patience and tolerance that come from living a farm life. I found that I could switch back and forth very easily. One day I could be with my mother down in White Plains shopping, and the next day I could be mucking out stalls with my father on one of the local dairy farms. As you say, we had a big Victorian house at the top of the hill, which came with a big barn. And my father, you know, moving to town was probably difficult for my father. We moved off of a farm, Deep Lake Farm, in Lakeville. And so he slowly but surely started putting together a town farm. We had a pony named Tar Baby. who was probably the most obnoxious animal that ever lived. Every time you went anywhere near him, he bit you. I assume he bit everyone, not just me. We had chickens down in the basement of the barn, little bantam chickens where you had to gather four eggs for the size of a normal chicken egg. We had dogs and cats, and we had a rabbit named Half and Half. The story behind the rabbit is that every Easter, the department store over in Millerton, New York, at that time called Delson's, for years now it's been a big antique center right on Main Street, would do a window display. And in that display, they would put live chicks and baby bunnies. And when you went shopping at Delson's with your parents, you could enter to win a chick or a bunny at Easter. Well, one year we won a bunny. And he was half black and half white. A very little bunny when we brought him home, who grew into a monster bunny. As I recall, as a child, I think the thing must have weighed 40 pounds. And we kept him out in the barn in an old crib, a baby crib. And Half and Half didn't do much except lay there and eat stuff. But he was part of the menagerie. My parents raised Morgan horses. My dad drove at the track up on Wells Hill Road. I rode at Lucy Drummond's over in Salisbury through a lot of my childhood. So as kids, even though we didn't live on what would normally be considered a farm, we still had barn chores. And we learned what it was to care about living things for their own sake. My dad had a huge vegetable garden, and I remember that my job was always to pinch the suckers off the tomato plants so that they would produce more tomatoes. As a matter of fact, I was just in Maine with my brother, and I was slicing a store-bought tomato, and I looked at him and I said, whatever happened to real tomatoes? You cannot buy a real tomato anymore. Tomatoes my father grew were so luscious that as kids I can remember just plucking one off the vine, warm from the sun, and standing in the garden eating it as it was. I can remember pulling an ear of corn and shucking it right there and eating raw corn. Well, anyway, my job was to pull the suckers off the tomato plants. My sister's job, because she had such tiny fingers, she had to get down on her knees and weed. I made sure I was no good at weeding so that I was never required to do that. But it was a true blessing to have been able to grow up that way.
Yeah. All right. After you graduated from college and married and stayed in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania for a number of years before your marriage dissolved and you came back to Salisbury. Where did you and Sarah came back to Salisbury, your daughter Sarah came back to Salisbury. Where did you work?
I had an assortment of jobs over the years that I was back in Salisbury. The first job I had was for community service. You all, at this point in time, I believe, know it as Harrington's. It was the local hardware store and lumber yard. And when I moved back, the main store had just burned to the ground. Horrible, horrible loss for the community. And the store was operating out of a very small building on the same property, just basically trying to provide as much service as possible until a new store could be built. I came back and I went to work for Mike Tenor, who owned Community Lumber and Hardware at that point. And really just as a clerk, I had just gotten divorced. I had an 8-year-old daughter who I was raising on my own. I really just wanted to stand at a register and ring people up. But as it turned out, when they were ready to set up the new building, Mike asked me if I would be the manager of it. And it was a fabulous experience. I became well versed in lumber and hardware. I traveled to Florida. I traveled to Nashville, Tennessee. I got to go to a lot of places for hardware conventions. And I was one woman in a male-dominated industry. There were very, very few women who worked in hardware and lumber at that time. It was a job I loved. I knew every contractor in the northwestern corner, and it's a job I miss to this day.
You know, speaking of jobs and going back a little farther than Community, you were in on the very beginnings of Harney Tea.
That's right. I had known the Harneys all my life. Michael Harney and I are the same age. Went all through elementary school together. When I first got back, when I left Community, I guess, I ran into another old friend of mine who was also a childhood buddy, Patty O'Loughlin. And I'm just going to do a little aside here before I move on to Harney Tea, because speaking of Patty O'Loughlin, she grew up in the neighborhood that was across from the Lincoln City Road going up to the elementary school. Patty and I walked back and forth to school. Yes, folks, we had to walk to school. We did not have a bus. So on the way home from school every Monday, because we had both gotten our allowance on Friday, on Monday afternoon we stopped at the Lakeville Apothecary, which today in 2013 I believe is a Chinese restaurant. But in those days, it was the local drugstore. And Patty and I would go there after school on Mondays and sit at the counter. They had stools at the counter. And the Gentiles, who ran the Lakeville Apothecary, made fabulous hot fudge sundaes. And Patty and I would spend our allowance on a hot fudge sundae that we would share, and we would each get a comic book. Because in those days, comic books were huge. And the Gentiles had the best selection of comic books anywhere. And this was a time when not only were comic books about superheroes, but there were just as many comic books that were romance comic books. They were love stories. And so Patty and I would each get a love story comic book, and we would sit at the counter with Mrs. Gentile and eat our hot fudge sundae and read a love story comic book. I remember that like it was today. Well, anyway, when I came back, I ran into Patty one day on the street, and I said I was looking for work. And she said, "Oh, I work at Harney Tea, and they're just now thinking about bringing on another person." I said, "Well, I don't know anything about tea." And she said, "Well, neither did I when I started working there." At this time, it was the very beginnings of what people know today as Harney Tea. And it all took place in one room on the back of the Harney's house in downtown Salisbury, right across from the White Hart Inn. And at that time, we were selling tea to Williams-Sonoma. They had their own private label that was actually Harney Tea. And big hotels and restaurants all over the world. The Plaza in New York, big hotels in London. And what would happen is they would buy tea from overseas, and it would come delivered to Salisbury in these huge wooden chests. And we would pry the lids off those chests and blend teas out in the driveway. The only other employee was Sally Larosky. And I knew Sally from my childhood on Deep Lake Farm. The Laroskys were another farm family. And so Sally Larosky, Patty O'Loughlin, and I would be up to our armpits blending teas for the Harneys. And this was the very beginning of their mail order business, which I continued to help them develop for the next several years, until they had gone from a trifold piece of paper that they mailed out to about 20 people to a four-color glossy catalog, as you may have seen it today, that goes out to several thousand people. I learned to appreciate fine tea, to know the difference between teas and different gardens, and green tea, brown tea, black tea, flavored tea. And one of the things I remember the most is that the chamomile tea would come to us directly from Egypt. And it was unlike anything that you get in a regular store-bought chamomile tea bag. And we would open that box, and the scent of those flowers was just incredible. And we would find all kinds of stuff in the tea, because the workers in Egypt really didn't care. If they were getting rid of something, if they had a wrapper from something, they just throw it right in the box with the chamomile. Today, the Harneys have a huge center over in Millerton. They produce bottled iced teas. It's really a very, very different thing than it was in its infancy in that little room behind the Harney's house.
Thank you. That's a interesting story. You've touched on community service, you've touched on the Harneys. Tell us about Noble Horizons.
I went to Noble Horizons and applied for a job as the front desk receptionist. I had seen the job in the Lakeville Journal, and I had thought, oh, I love people. I love elders. Have a deep and abiding respect for the wisdom and life experience of elders. I think that's a job that I would really enjoy. Well, the minute I walked in the door, I was redirected. Another childhood friend, Joanne Erickson, who is, today Joanne Moore, ran what was called the recreational therapy department at Noble. We had known each other for many, many years. She heard that I was applying for a job as a front desk receptionist, and she needed somebody in her department. So she came and stole me out of my interview and said, no, I want her in my department, and proceeded to train me in recreational therapy, which is basically bringing life enrichment to the residents of a long-term care facility. I worked on Wagner Terrace, which was a unit where people needed nursing supervision, needed somebody to oversee their medications, and to be right there if they needed them. But these were people who were still intellectually and physically pretty independent. I learned how to provide programming for spiritual, physical, emotional, intellectual enrichment. And I loved my years at Noble. It was there that I felt my first calling to go into the ministry. I loved the fact that Noble provided a chapel, which very, very few long-term care facilities provide anymore. The populations have changed so much. So I went from doing therapeutic recreation to pursuing certification in what's called clinical pastoral education, which certifies someone to be able to provide spiritual care in prisons, long-term care facilities, drug rehabs, places like that. I started investigating where I could study for that certification, and it turned out that there were only two places in the state of Connecticut that provided that, and one of them was Noble Horizons' sister facility, Avery Heights, in Hartford, Connecticut. So I went from working full-time at Noble Horizons to working half-time at Noble and half-time at Avery Heights in Hartford while I studied for my CPE. Eventually, when I finished that certification, Avery Heights hired me as their full-time chaplain, and I began spending 4 days a week in Hartford living on the Avery Heights campus, and commuting back to Salisbury on the weekends. At this point, my daughter had gone on to live independently. She had was going to school at Southern Connecticut State University to become certified to work with autistic children. So I began splitting my time between Salisbury and Hartford at that point.
All right, Donna, in the years you were growing up, tell us a little bit about race relations, your friends among the Black community.
Well, as I was growing up in Lakeville, I really had no idea that there was a difference between myself and someone who had darker skin. I had a lot of Black friends, the Branch family, the MacArthurs. We all grew up together, we all played together, went back and forth to each other's houses. I grew up with Black families in the Methodist Church, where my father was very active, the Folkses. It wasn't until I went away to college that I realized that there was any difference. I went to a college that wasn't Deep South, but was right on the Mason-Dixon line. And of course, I went to college in the 70s, which was a socially radical time. There was a lot of change going on in this country. And when I arrived on the Gettysburg College campus, I was a little nonplussed to discover that there was a Black student union and a white student union. And I, at first, couldn't quite figure that out. But it wasn't because of enforced segregation. It was self-segregation, excuse me, on the part of the African American students. They were quite radicalized at the time. Most of them dressed in dashikis, Malcolm X was a revered figure. And it took me my entire freshman year to get my equilibrium as far as that was concerned. I would come back home and nothing had changed here in bucolic Lakeville, Connecticut. Everybody still grew up together, played together. Besides the difference in, you know, with the race relations in town, I also encountered my first work living with handicapped people. There was a boy in my class growing up who was in a wheelchair, Randy Wilson. So I also learned to not think any differently of somebody who was physically challenged. So I really grew up in a place with very little prejudice. It wasn't until I got to the outside world that I realized where I lived was different.
Well, I thank you very much, Donna, for giving us this good view of what Lakeville was like when you were growing up. If you have anything that you haven't touched on that you feel needs to be said, we've still got a few minutes on this tape. Otherwise,
well, I think what I really want to convey on this tape is that I know you have collected many, many oral histories from many generations that have lived in the Lakeville-Salisbury area. The community is always evolving. When I came back here, a lot of New Yorkers had moved into the area, and there was friction between country people and city people. So I don't want to give the impression that it remains stagnant. It grows and changes over time. But I will go to my grave saying that the years I grew up here were the best of the years.
Thank you very much, Donna.